Good evening. My name is Terry Orm. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I want to thank you very much for coming out tonight. These Trib Talk Live events are our way of identifying and discussing, bringing a discussion out to you, the public, on the most important issues facing Salt Lake City and facing Utah. I can't imagine a more important issue than the one we're here to talk about tonight. Sexual assault on university campuses in Utah. I'd like to thank our panelists for coming, and I'd also like to thank KCPW, our partner in this, and the Leonardo. And I'm going to turn it over to Roger McDonough, news host of KCPW. Roger, by the way, hosts our Friday morning show, Behind the Headlines, 9 o'clock on KCPW, which we also discuss the important issues of the day, of the week, the big news of the week, with Tribune journalists. So again, thank you very much for coming. I'm gonna turn it over to Roger.
Thanks, Terry, and thanks for the radio plug as well. And thanks to everyone who's come out to the Leonardo tonight for this conversation, which is being streamed live at sltrib.com and recorded for later broadcast on KCPW Public Radio. Our panel this evening, as Terry said, is about confronting rape culture at Utah colleges. And that might suggest a problem that is unique to our state, but the statistics, of course, tell another story. According to a survey of 150,000 students at 27 colleges and universities commissioned last year by the Association of American Universities, 27% of female college seniors reported that since entering college, they had experienced some kind of unwanted sexual contact. 27%. Other studies have shown pretty consistently that between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 women at U.S. colleges will be a victim of sexual assault. What's more, this problem is probably even more widespread due to several barriers that prevent victims from reporting what has happened to them. Among the most cited of those barriers is that student victims don't trust their universities to appropriately handle their case. And in Utah, as you will hear through the course of tonight's conversation, there are other institution-specific reporting barriers. The problem of campus sexual assault isn't new, but in the past few years, and in part because of a national student movement aimed at helping victims and potential victims advocate for their rights, as well as because of an increase in the number of survivors coming forward, there has been an unprecedented national focus on this issue. How can schools prevent this from happening? What can schools do to better respond to sexual assault when it does occur? What does the prevalence of campus sexual assault do to the ability of victims, largely women but also men, to have equal access to education? And of course, how does it affect the lives of victims and society at large? Some of the questions that we hope to be able to speak to during this panel tonight. Here, as part of this discussion, I'm pleased to have a remarkable panel of guests with me. I spoke about survivors coming forward at the national level. To my immediate right here, Maddie Barney filed a federal complaint against Brigham Young University after she says the school blocked her from enrolling in classes after she reported to the police that she was raped. She later authored a petition to get the school to change how it handles sexual assault investigations. Jody Peterson, to her right, is a sexual assault support advocate with the University of Utah's Center for Student Wellness, which offers confidential assistance to students, faculty, and staff who have experienced sexual violence. Next to her, Steve Evans is an attorney and co-founder of the Mormon blog By Common Consent. The blog has examined honor code and sexual assault investigations at Brigham Young University. And Salt Lake Tribune Justice reporter Aaron Alberty is here with us also. Alberty has reported extensively on campus sexual assault in Utah and especially in recent months. And please join me in welcoming our panel with your applause. And I'll mention for those of you in attendance here this evening that we will engage in a question and answer segment following this discussion. That will be in about 45 minutes time, thanks to the unforgiving public radio clock. Also, for those of you watching online, if you want to engage this topic, use the hashtag TribSexAssault. It's here on our slide. Well, there's no simple way to jump into this topic, but I think that to begin with, it's worthwhile looking at, in the context of the wider national conversation, What has been happening here in Utah and why this has been in the news lately? And for that, I'll turn to you, reporter Aaron Alberti. In April, news broke that students at Brigham Young University who reported sexual assault faced a somewhat unique secondary consequence of reporting what had happened to them. Can you tell us about that and how this news came to light?
In April, during a sexual assault awareness event at BYU, one of the students there and one of our panelists tonight, Maddie Barney, raised the issue of reporting sexual violence at BYU, said that she had been investigated by the Honor Code office for Honor Code violations in connection to a rape that she had reported last September in an off-campus apartment in Provo. After that event, at which the Honor Code, the Title IX director spoke, several other students came forward and started talking to local media about their experiences and echoed the account that Maddie Barney had given us.
Okay. Maddie Barney, I know that for legal reasons there's a good deal that you can't say when it comes to your own rape, your own assault. I'm wondering if you can convey just the basics of what happened, and then also looking at what Aaron's been pointing to, the involvement of the Honor Code Office at BYU in that reporting process, because at first you were hesitant to come forward with what had happened to you, correct?
Yeah, so I was raped in September in an off-campus apartment by a man that I knew, or I thought I knew. I mean, he lied about everything to me, and I found out after I reported. But I reported to the Provo police. I purposely didn't report to BYU because I was kind of aware of what was going on with the honor code being used to punish victims, but I didn't really know if it was true. I just didn't want to risk it. I mean, I was living in BYU housing. I'd been going to BYU for a year and a half. My education was really important to me. And so I reported to Provo police. They charged him, arrested him, etc. It's pending trial. But I mean, just a couple months after that, I mean, when I was going through the most horrific time in my life, when I was going through therapy, when I was trying to understand what had happened to me, I got a call over Thanksgiving break. I remember I was in the store with my mom. It was actually an email, and it was just from the Honor Code office, and it just said something along the lines of, "We need to meet with you." And I didn't know what it was about. I didn't know if it was related to the rape. I didn't know. I had no clue. And so I tried to get a hold of them for a week. They weren't returning my calls. And then finally, I got through to a Title IX investigator who told me the nature of what was going on. She said, we obtained a copy of your police report in which you said that you were raped, and it seems that there's also some honor code violations in there.
Aaron Alberti, Maddie wasn't alone in her hesitancy to come forward, as she's pointed out here. There were others who didn't want to come forward because of the fact that they recognized that something similar could conceivably happen to them, and you spoke with some of those victims as well. Is that correct?
In all, we've spoken to about 50 people, current and former students at BYU, who said that they were sexually assaulted while they were students. Most of them didn't report, and many of those people said that they didn't report because they were afraid of being punished under the honor code. In fact, several students said that the person that they said assaulted them specifically lorded the threat of an honor code investigation over them.
There's a statement from a Provo police sergeant that appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune that speaks to this, and we've got a slide of it here as well. The Tribune quoted him as saying, "Any sex crimes investigator will tell you that an offender will use whatever pressure he thinks will get a victim to not report. He'll threaten to hurt you, he'll threaten to embarrass you, he'll threaten to tell an employer, he'll tell a kid, your mom won't love you if you tell anybody. This behavior is just part of that victimology. There's one more handle that an offender has over the victim. Oh, this person goes to school at an institution that is allergic to sex, so I can hold this over them." That's Provo Police Sergeant Brian Taylor talking about the behavior of some offenders. Allergic to sex is an interesting point here, and it's not necessarily specific to BYU. There's a larger cultural context here, but what about how attitudes about sex at BYU play into this? It's a private school. There's a moral code that has something to say about everything from attire to sex and engaging in sex. If it's having an effect on both a victim, but is also being used as a tool by a perpetrator, it's not something I want to gloss over. And is there some way that we can lean into this this topic of sexuality at Brigham Young University, exploring that? I don't know. Does anybody want to tackle that? There's no direct question here, I'm realizing.
Well, I think that it perpetuates victim blaming, especially with rape and sexual assault, because any bit of sex can kind of be turned around, especially in a culture like that, and say, you know, this was your fault. Like, what were you wearing? I've gotten that question a lot. What were you doing before the rape? I've gotten that question. I mean, just things that are completely inappropriate.
Those are common, I mean, those are common, and Jody Peterson, I'll bring you in on this as well. Those are common phrases that survivors of sexual assault hear. What were you wearing? You know, how did you instigate this? And they're really the wrong questions to be asking.
Correct. And I also, when I started in this business, I thought that the what were you wearing question had gone away with the dinosaurs, but it's still something that's very present. But not only is it victim blaming, but men should be offended by that, right? If you are so sexually aroused by somebody wearing a mini skirt that you can't control yourself, you probably shouldn't be in the general population. So tell men in the audience, tell me if I'm wrong on that. Are you offended by that? I'm offended by that.
I'm offended by that. Steve Evans, with the blog By Common Consent, you attended Brigham Young University, but you're also one of those who has expressed some concerns about how the school handled sexual assault or has been handling sexual assault. What were your first thoughts when you learned about a case like Maddie's making their way into honor code investigations from either a law enforcement agency or Title IX investigations? What was your initial response there?
I felt sick.
Unfortunately, due to an issue with Steve Evans' microphone at the live panel, his answer here is inaudible. We've had a producer voice them up so that you can hear what he said.
I felt sick. I think it's extremely hypocritical for a religious institution to let a crime go unreported or to deter a victim from reporting a crime so that the overall specter of worthiness can be preserved. I think it's a false choice. I think it's illusory. I don't think it's real spirituality. You mentioned the comments of the Title IX coordinator at a meeting in April. I wasn't there, but my understanding is that her statements were to the effect that, yes, we take the victim's circumstances and we report those to the Honor Code office, and we don't apologize for that. I think it's something that they should apologize for.
You know, In the wake of concerns expressed by the likes of Steve and in the wake of activism by victims, BYU is now reevaluating some policies related to how it responds to sexual assault. The school's president, Kevin J. Worthen, says that changes will be made. The school formed an advisory council and created a website to take public comment, which received thousands of responses. We invited BYU to participate in tonight's panel. And while they declined, researcher and nursing professor Julie Valentine agreed to appear in a video. Valentine is a forensic nurse, sexual assault victims advocate, and a member of BYU's Advisory Council on Campus Response to Sexual Assault, and will now play her video for you.
I just want to thank all the people that are here at this forum. Sexual assault is throughout our community. And the only way that we are going to make any changes is by having multiple voices. The voices of survivors, critically important. The voices of every single discipline, law enforcement, forensic nurses, forensic scientists, every discipline, and the voices of community. That's the only way that we're going to bring about lasting change. I also want to encourage that we take a expansive look at this. If we narrowly focus on one institution, that actually diminishes the scope of the problem. This is throughout our community, sadly. It's throughout all colleges and universities, and we need to look at all aspects and say, we need to do better. We have to do better for our victims.
At this point in the panel, a question on the overhead screen reads, what is BYU's advisory council doing?
We are taking a very broad approach, which exactly is what is recommended for best practices. We're the only school that I know of that set up a feedback mechanism, this feedback website, which has been incredibly helpful. We are reading all of those comments, and there's a lot. We read those. We are sorting through those. We've been meeting with key organizations on campus, such as the Counseling Center, BYU Police, Women's Resources, Title IX Office, Honor Code Office. We are having in-depth interviews with all of them. I've been meeting with any survivors that have reached out to me. We've been meeting also with those in the community in Utah County. So that has been representatives from Center for Women and Children in Crisis, Provo City Victim Advocates.
What issues have people raised with BYU's advisory council?
Been questions about what's the relationship between the Title IX office and the Honor Code office. We are looking at that in depth. We have some people that have shared stories with us, personal experiences. Others have given feedback.
What might be done to help prevent sexual assault?
Many students really don't understand what constitutes rape or sexual assault. So that's a very important educational need. The other is really understanding what consent means. So those can be seen as very basic, but yet there is a huge amount of misunderstanding as to what that means. And so that's something that we are looking at as to how do we provide that education. And this isn't just for BYU. This is all campuses. Other studies have found that there's a lack of understanding in those areas.
There's a website here, feedback2016.byu.edu. That's the website that Julie Valentine mentioned for providing feedback to the university. I'll start, I think, with you, Steve Evans. There's a sort of investigatory process going on at BYU. Is this, to you, the fact that BYU is seeking feedback and is engaging in this process, is this a hopeful sign to you?
I think it's the right thing for them to do. Whether or not it should have been done earlier before this crisis came up is a question that I think everybody can ask. It's an easy question to ask, but it's a good one. But no, they're doing the right thing. They're asking the right questions, and they're bringing the right people. And Julie Valentine is great, and I think they're doing the right thing.
Maddie Barney, I want to give you a chance to address Julie Valentine's comments. This is, of course, personal to you, but can you talk about what you want to see done differently at BYU and how this process that the school is going through, how that looks to you?
Well, first of all, I was just concerned in the video how she kept pointing out that this is a problem on other campuses, and yes, it is, but it is unique to BYU to have an honor code that kicks out rape victims. That is definitely unique. But as to changes that I would like to see, I'm seeking an amnesty clause. I have a petition already. Mainly what it's going to do is it's going to make sure that once a victim reports to Title IX, which is where you report sexual assault and rape cases, that it does not leave Title IX. It doesn't go to the honor code. It can't be used to kick you out. And if somebody were to go to the honor code and if something were to be a Title IX violation, honor code would send them right over to Title IX. That would be the end of it.
Okay, and an amnesty for any honor code violations as a result. And you've had a lot of people sign this petition, correct?
Over, I think it's at like 120,000 now.
There's also, in addition to the Title IX office, there's a law enforcement angle. And Aaron, I will ask you this question. This is to Maddie's story and to the story of other victims of sexual assault at Brigham Young that is troubling to some people. Maddie mentioned this, I think, before. This has to do with officers from two separate agencies, the BYU Police Department and the Utah County Sheriff's Office. Can you tell us about this part of the story?
Yeah, this part gets a little complicated, so bear with me. BYU's Honor Code Office first learned about Maddie's rape report when an acquaintance of the suspect, who was a Utah County Sheriff's deputy, took her case file, which the defendant in the case had acquired through discovery, and alerted the BYU Honor Code Office that this had gone on. Now, before he brought in the case file, which he did eventually do, the Tribune had obtained internal BYU documents that show that the Honor Code Office, upon getting his phone call, called BYU police and asked questions about Maddie Barney's case. And then the records for the document access software, the access log, showed that a BYU police lieutenant, immediately after getting that request from the Honor Code Office, looked through the case file and then reported back to the Honor Code Office about it. However, it was a few days later that they obtained the entire file from this sheriff's deputy, who, along with the defendant in the rape case, was charged with witness retaliation. However, the county attorney then dropped the charge against the sheriff's deputy for witness retaliation. He said that there were details in his internal affairs interview with the sheriff's department that were exculpatory. However, the county attorney won't say what those details were. The deputy's attorney, his defense attorney, said that he was concerned about male athletes at BYU committing sexual assault, and the sheriff said that he was concerned about protecting female athletes. It's not clear what connection either of those two interests has to the case, since neither Maddie nor the suspect is an athlete.
Do we know how, just how common, have you investigated to see whether this is a sort of isolated incident where law enforcement is passing information on to the Honor Code Office, and what have you found, if anything, along those lines?
Well, my colleague Jessica Miller had submitted several public records requests to different law enforcement agencies in Utah County, trying to get an idea of, you know, how often BYU police were accessing records in off-campus and outside of jurisdiction rape cases, sexual assault cases. We've received denials for those requests, citing an investigation by the state's Department of Public Safety, which the state says was launched at the request of BYU police as sort of a self-auditing measure. The investigation, however, began one day after Jessica filed those public records requests, so we're not sure what role that request may have played in initiating the investigation.
All right. Okay, well, I want to broaden the scope of this conversation a little bit, and I'd actually like to turn back to a comment that Julie Valentine made in her video. She mentions there being not a good understanding of what constitutes consent, and she says that there's a poor grasp of what consent is and a poor understanding of what rape is. Jody Peterson, is what consent is more poorly understood by college students in Utah than elsewhere? Do we know that? Is there a way of gauging that?
I don't think there's anything, I don't think that Utah is especially naive when it comes to talking about consent, but I think that our lack of sexual education is a big part of why we have a problem with consent. Conversations around consent typically happen when we're talking to young people about healthy sexuality. And so if we can't talk with them about these things, they are going to their peers, who often know less than they even know about it, or they're going to the internet. And when you type into any search engine sexual education or any kind of sexually nuanced word, you're not going to get healthy results back.
That's true. I know nothing about that, but no. That's Steve Evans, can you? I'm hoping that you can weigh in on this as well. We talk about potential policy changes at not on search
You're
terms,
on your
please,
own.
But we talk about potential policy changes from a school like BYU, and we have to consider that cultural aspect, not just at BYU, but at other schools here in Utah and across a wider community of faith, I think, where we see a culture that maybe shies away from talking about sex generally. And that can be a problem, as Jody said, in terms of sex education. I don't know if this is something that you've written about at the blog, but if there's something to be said about addressing this in a more fundamental way from an educational perspective.
Sure. And speaking from my own perspective, I'm LDS. For me, sex is something that is sacred. It is something that is part of an eternal nature, and the doctrine sort of goes along with that. But along with that is a heavy culture of morality and a heavy culture of modesty, you know, stuff like that, that historically has been imposed upon women and tends to exculpate or let men off the hook for their actions or be able to transfer some of those actions onto women. Well, I couldn't control myself, says the man, because the woman was dressed immodestly. That's something problematic, and it's something that goes back many, many, many decades. And I often wonder, is that rooted in a patriarchal culture? Is it something endemic to that? Is it rooted in simply not keeping up with the times, or, you know, notions of consent that have been in place for decades that have not trickled through to conservative religious communities generally? That can be a problem as well. So I think about those things, and I don't have any clear answers, but we're looking at some of these procedural things that have gone on, the interaction between the Honor Code Office and Title IX, how the Honor Code is enforced at BYU. Those are symptoms that have to be addressed, but I think that there is a deeper cultural and religious aspect to it that also needs to be addressed.
Aaron Alberti, in terms of other survivors of sexual assault that you spoke with, I've read quotes in the Tribune in which survivors talked about getting some sort of education from family or peers about a man not being able to control himself, or about misconceptions having to do with sex. Was that a prevalent thing that you encountered among survivors?
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit I have been quite surprised. I talked to probably a couple dozen at least, a few dozen people telling me about sexual abuse against them and sort of the understandings that they had at the time that it happened, not understanding the nature of consent, not knowing like sort of the detailed level of consent that can be given but then can be taken away. Consenting to one thing doesn't mean consenting to all things. And I was a little surprised. I wondered if it was just because I'm a public safety reporter and I've been dealing with sex crime cases for a long time now. But then I look back, I mean, when I was in high school, I remember, hearing about all this, and I feel like I don't know if there's been sort of a backstep in the understanding. I wondered if it was just a local thing, but then when the Stanford rape case came to light, some of the reactions to that, I was like, oh, this is not just Utah, this is all over the place, because the reactions to that were very inconsistent with legal definitions of sex crime.
I want to also address, and this is Jody Peterson, a question for you, there's that lack of understanding about consent or what rape means, but there are also a number of myths about who are perpetrators of rape, about who the victims are. Maybe we can address some of those and dispel some of those. And I know that you have a list. What are some of the most common myths having to do with rape and sexual assault?
I think the number one rape myth is that you are going to be raped by a stranger. It's going to be somebody jumping out of bushes in the middle of the night, just waiting to pounce on some woman who's walking at night alone. And they'll overcome the victim through use of a weapon or an element of surprise. So what we have with this particular rape myth is another barrier for victims to come forward to report or to even seek help. They are so confused by what has happened that they're having a hard time wrapping their brain around the idea that they were in fact raped, because there's a big difference. You know, we as young women, from the time we're little girls, we're taught how to protect ourselves from being raped. And on a daily basis, we're kind of going through this mental tally of, I'm going to have my keys between my fingers, I'm going to park in well-lit spaces, I'm going to have mace. You know, we have a grocery list of things that we do on a daily basis to prevent ourselves from being raped. But who is the rapist in that scenario? It's the boogeyman. It's not the cute guy in my chem class. And so a lot of times victims are so confused by what has happened that they'll go to a trusted friend, a family member, even clergy, to get some direction about what has happened to them. And depending on how that first person that they divulge to reacts will carry a lot of weight in depending if that victim is going to go forward to report or to get any kind of help or services.
And that's one of, I mean, we talked earlier about some very BYU-specific barriers to reporting sexual assault, but that, how that initial response is a barrier. What are some of the other reasons that people won't come forward? Have we addressed this a little bit already?
Well, I'm happy to go over anything you want me to. I think that, yes, definitely that is a big barrier to reporting for victims. I think also they feel that they won't be believed. They, as ironic as this sounds, they're actually concerned for their rapist. I can't tell you how many times I've had a client come to my office and say something along the lines of, I don't want to ruin this guy's life. And oftentimes they'll say really complimentary things about their rapist. They'll say, you know, this person is a philanthropist, this person is going to do great things in their lifetime. And so most of the time, the concern that they have is for everybody but themselves. If they are concerned about their rapist, that's one thing. But then if they're concerned about their rapist raping somebody else, then that will prompt them to come forward, because they don't want to feel responsible if their assailant then goes on and rapes somebody else, which victims are never responsible for a rapist action. So I try to unburden them of that a little bit. But also, especially in college campus settings, there folks are still in kind of that narcissistic phase. Their brains aren't fully developed yet, and things are very much about the social circles that we run in, and how are people going to react to this? Are they going to believe me? Am I going to be retaliated against? Am I going to be socially ostracized? So those are big barriers for why people on campuses aren't reporting. Also, you know, what if my rapist is in one of my classes? It's just better for me to keep my head down and push through.
Who are the perpetrators of rape and sexual assault on campus? And are they, you know, are they people who do it once and don't do it again? Are the majority of them done by the same people? Maybe we can address that.
Okay, so I guess that to tell you a little story that will illuminate who rapists are is I had a lecture one time where the lecturer flashed up a picture on their PowerPoint that was a flock of sheep, and then off in the distance you could see the dogs that protect the flock, and then you can also see very evidently a wolf in sheep's clothing. And he says, now who do you think that the sheep have to be afraid of? And so, you know, popcorn out through the audience, people are popping up with, probably the dogs. The dogs might get hungry and turn on the sheep. Oh, of course it's going to be the wolf in sheep's clothing. And he said, wrong. They need to be afraid of the other sheep, because they look just like everybody else. And what we do know of rapists, and this is based on the work from Dr. David Lisak, he said that rapists most often are not one-time rapists. They'll on average will have six victims. So to me, that says that this person is, I hate the analogy of this, but I'm at a loss for words right now, but rapists almost treat what they're doing like a hobby. They are doing everything that they can to make this appearance that they are a good guy. Like I said before, they're a philanthropist. They're members, they're high members of the church, or, you know, they're doing a lot of these things to disguise themselves and to blend in with normal society. And so when a victim does come forward and say, this person raped me, then people are like, there is no way that that guy would have raped that guy, that raped her. I know this guy, and he would not have done this. But the simple fact of the matter is, victims also don't see that this person is a rapist either. And often they don't see that this person is a rapist until it's too late.
You know, something you said speaks to a topic that I'd like to address, and it's kind of a touchy one, which is the notion of false reporting of sexual assault, that there are there's some percentage of rapes reported that were invented by the victim. And Jody, I'm wondering if you can help us get a better sense of the numbers behind that idea, because while it happens very infrequently, mm-hmm. right?
True. So to give you an idea of how many false reports of rape that there are, there is no evidence to indicate that there are any more false reports of rape than are of any other crime. So if you believe that somebody's gonna make up a lie that my neighbor stole my lawnmower, then maybe you're gonna believe that a woman would make up a lie to say that she was raped. But I think that one of the reasons it's so hard for us to believe in rape is because it's such a horrible thing to have happen. And I think that we don't wanna believe that boogeymen aren't hiding under our bed, or we want to believe that boogeymen are hiding under our bed. We don't want to believe that they're the person I'm on a bowling league with. Mm.
You know, universities around the United States have come under fire for not doing enough when it comes to prevention, for having an inadequate response to sexual assault, and that includes lax penalties for, or even no penalties whatsoever for perpetrators in a lot of instances. Aaron Alberti, schools tend to want to protect themselves from damages, and that can be a problem when it comes to being able to provide a safe environment for students. This is kind of a PR aspect of universities wanting to protect themselves both from a reputation among people who are prospective students or from, say, alumni, but also from, I guess, say, litigation. Is this something that you've encountered in your reporting?
Well, the public's awareness of the incidence of sexual assault on any campus usually starts with the Clery Act. It's the law that requires colleges to report incidents of certain violent crimes. And it's kind of a confusing measure because it limits the reporting requirement to campus proper. Especially in Utah, where a lot of our campuses are commuter colleges, commuter schools, most of student life occurs off campus. Most students live off campus. You know, socializing occurs off campus. So it's hard to get an accurate read on what, just from that data, what's actually going on. And that would apply anywhere. I mean, go ahead, sorry.
Well, can we talk about, actually, there's something that this makes me think of, which is the conflict or the overlapping ways of reporting sexual assault on campus. So you can, you know, maybe it occurs on campus, maybe it occurs off campus, but you as a student can report it to your Title IX office, you can report it to law enforcement, you can have two overlapping things happening at once. Is there a tension there? Is there a better route to go? And what are the outcomes for both of those routes generally? Do we have a good sense of that?
I actually would defer to Jody for this.
So if I understand correctly, you're asking why someone would prefer to report to campus authority?
Well, or why go one route or the other? I mean,
okay.
Yeah, maybe
okay.
We can address that.
I think that one of the reasons that victims will choose to go through Title IX or the Title IX director is, as opposed to law enforcement, is because they feel like this isn't going to ruin the perpetrator's life, which they don't want to do. But then they also feel like they just want somebody to tell this person that raped them that this wasn't okay. And they don't want to see their rapist go away to prison for exponential amount of years, you know. So this that also feeds back into that myth of people make up rape and people make false reports of rape. It's so far the opposite direction. Our statistics say that maybe 90% of rapes are not even reported.
That's a massive statistic. We're talking about Title IX right now, and what I'm thinking is that maybe we should define what it is as a statute in federal law. I've got a slide with sort of the crib notes that says, Title IX is a comprehensive federal law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in federally funded education programs. So essentially the idea is that sexual assault or rape amounts to discrimination and prevents people from having equal access to education. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so a person who has been a victim of sexual assault can go to the Title IX office, they can go to law enforcement, or they can go both routes. But it seems from my cursory understanding that neither of them end up with a very strong success rate in terms of coming up with some sort of punishment for the perpetrator, and sometimes they can be drawn out processes. Erin.
Yeah, our reporters looked at the data from the public schools in Utah and found that there were 40 cases where the schools adjudication process substantiated a victim's claim of sexual misconduct. Three of those ended in an expulsion. About 15, I think it was, resulted in a temporary suspension of the accused in those cases. So, and students have reported, and this is reporting that has dealt with other schools. I know there was one student at the University of Utah that described, I think, a 9-month process right. for something that is supposed to take maybe half that long, according to the national experts. Others saying the number of appeals that you go through means you have to keep retelling it and reconvincing different people every time. One of the students that was quoted in the Tribune said that it was almost not worth it to her.
Yeah, and actually we've got a slide that says Sorry. That it's from, no, it's you're fine, it's a University of Utah student who said that it took a year for her complaint to be resolved, and she still had to be at school with her attacker that entire time. I'm noticing that we don't have a lot of time left, and there's a lot of topics that we should cover that we're inevitably not going to be able to get to during this conversation, but there are a couple of things that I definitely want to make certain we address. And among those is the experience of the victim, and not just in terms of sort of this legal bureaucracy, but Maddie Barney, you are a survivor of sexual violence. You're here engaging in this conversation tonight, and I want to ask you how your life has changed as a result of this, because among people who haven't been raped, who haven't been assaulted, there's probably a lot that doesn't get considered. And so personally, socially, mentally, and emotionally, what has this done to your life?
I think that people have this idea of victims as, you know, after you're raped, you go hide in your room and cry for a week, and then you're fine. I mean, it's been 9 months since my rape, and I'm still dealing with it every day. There is not an hour that goes by that I did not think about it. I've been to extensive therapy. I've been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder from the rape. I have friends asking me now, like, why are you not okay? And they just don't understand. I mean, people think that you just get better, that is something that you just get over, but it's just not. I mean, it's something that's gonna impact my life forever, and I wish it wasn't, but it is.
And that's the reality. Jody, on your end, I know you engage in education to try to get everyone to know, is this sort of a typical victim's experience that I mean, I guess there probably is no typical victim's experience.
That's true. There is no typical victim experience, and no two rapes are going to be the same. We can see a broad spectrum of how folks are dealing with their victimization, but yes, it is true. It's something that is going to be a part of your life forever, and there is not a person on the face of the earth that should tell you how you should heal from this process. It's the same as like telling somebody who has had the
or suffered the death of a child, you should never tell them how they're supposed to grieve. And that should go for victims of any kind of a traumatic event as well. I do know, you know, everybody has a different way, a different modality that they're going to use to heal. You know, some of them become activists like Maddie has. But some of them are not able to recover from this, and some of them will end up turning to drugs or other ways to cope with what has happened to them. And we have this concept in our mind of what a rape victim looks like, and if that victim doesn't look and act the way we think they should, then we don't believe that they truly are victims.
If they don't fit into that box. So there's no time frame. I mean, in terms of healing, it just depends.
No, it takes as long as it takes.
And healing being a process, of course. It occurs to me that something that we haven't really addressed while we're having this conversation is we're talking about confronting rape culture on Utah campuses. What is rape culture? What defines rape culture? I mean, it's what allows attacks like Maddie's to occur?
Yeah, I would say, just to break it down in as simple of terms as possible, is rape culture is anything that we as a society do or say that takes responsibility off of a rapist and puts it onto a victim. So when we say, what were you wearing, we've now kind of played that shell game where we're trying to move the coconuts around so that you can't tell what's really happening. What's really happening is this person raped and violated another person, and who do we choose to victimize even more? The victim.
Aaron, in your reporting, because we're running low on time, I want to get to a couple of topics that I think are important, and I'm wondering if you've had conversations that have identified specific steps that schools can take to better prevent sexual assault. Have people come to you and said, this is what should be done at X, Y, or Z universities?
Well, I know that I think it's called Southern Virginia University. It's a school that's operated, it's got a LDS member owner. It's not owned by the church itself. But they revamped a lot of their protocols after an investigation in past years. And they did more awareness on campus, like campus education, identifying what consent is, what it isn't, what it covers when you give consent. And that's been the big thing that a lot of the people I've talked to have said. There was a man I talked to. I've talked to several men who reported being raped as well. And one of the things that he said, he was at a training at, I want to say Utah State, maybe, but it was for men trying to teach them not to rape women. And he was like, la la, this is so boring. I'm never gonna rape a woman, I'm a gay man. And then when they started talking about consent, he was like, oh, whoa, wait, that was me, except for I was the victim, not the offender. And it never even occurred to him. He started texting people like, has this ever happened to you? Well, you were raped. And nobody like had a clue. And he said that more programs kind of like that, so people know what to look for and know how to label what happened to them, is important. And that's something that was echoed by a number of the people that I spoke to who talked about sex crimes against them, that not being able to label what happened to them left them in a really bad position, not just in terms of whether they would report, but once they reported, not being able to advocate for themselves and not being able to say, this is what happened to me, define it as this, you know, wave that, you know, sound that alarm for the person that they're disclosing to. And it was a problem, I've talked to a number of students who said that it was a problem on the protective side, that in retrospect, they looked back and thought, oh, that was the grooming that happened. I didn't know what to look for because they were looking for the stranger in the bushes. One girl said she literally took a self-defense class to prevent rape. And when it happened to her, it was a friend. And she said that her whole mindset about how this was going to go down involved somebody jumping out at her with a weapon. And that's not what happened. And she was like, and partly, she's like, this was happening and I'm going through my head, like, I know what to do, but I can't do it. And she said that she was actually afraid of hurting him. She didn't think she was gonna have to hurt a friend with these tactics. So having some of these misunderstandings, it's a problem at like every point.
Right, and having those cleared up. And Jody, I wanna bring you on this. I'm thinking about preventative education. I went to the University of Utah, and it's been a few years, but I don't remember any freshman orientation on this topic. And is that something that that would be helpful, not just in terms of greater awareness, but in terms of actual, you know, actionable, knowing what is what and what how does it all fit into the same box?
Yeah, so when we talk about prevention of rape, most of the time our target audience is going to be women. So that puts men at a lot of a disadvantage, because if a man is raped, then they don't believe men can be raped, so that's another barrier for them. But when we talk about primary prevention, almost always the first place goes to take a self-defense course or carry mace or some other protective measure. And when I joined LinkedIn, I had people coming out of the woodwork wanting me to put my stamp of approval on their self-defense courses. And my question was always, do you educate on acquaintance rape? And if they said no, I said no, because I won't advocate for that, because many times when women have taken a self-defense course and then they are raped, that's just one more way that they have to blame themselves afterwards. I should have been able to fight my attacker off.
And I do want to echo something that Julie Valentine said when I interviewed her yesterday for the video that you played at the beginning, in terms of being able to recognize in advance predatory tactics. I mean, it's not always possible. I don't mean to imply that if this happens, you should have seen it coming or something like that. That, I mean, a predator's goal is to not be detected. So they'll do what they can. It's not like it's on you. But I'm saying that some of the people I spoke to, in retrospect, looking back, said, oh, that's why this, you know, it's, there may not be a...
Hindsight, I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
Understanding. I want to go through the panel here and still ask for actionable sort of steps that could be taken at any university to try and prevent sexual assault. And either Maddie or Steve, if you want to jump into this.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak on the idea that a victim can prevent rape, and that they're, I mean, what I've seen in a lot of the comment sections on articles about my case is, well, you know, if you were following the honor code, you wouldn't have been raped.
You should never read the comment section.
Oh, I try to avoid it, but sometimes you just have to see what people are thinking. And it's...
I'm kidding.
Normally not very good. So, I mean, I just wanted to speak to that. You know, the honor code is not like a magic wand that you wave and everybody's safe. You can't prevent somebody being raped by restricting alcohol or restricting what you wear or restricting what time you go out at night. It's just... what causes rape is the rapist.
You know, there's so much more to this conversation. We only sort of touched on the specific struggle of men who have been sexually assaulted and the different reporting barriers to finding support for them. We're not getting to some of the important legal questions, and there's a lot more to discuss around this topic, but hopefully we've provided at least a foundation for additional conversations to come. With the time that we have left, though, I'm hoping that we can open this up to a question and answer period. But before I do, I want to thank our panelists once more for being here. Maddie Barney, Jody Peterson, Steve Evans, and Aaron Alverdu. Thanks very much. Okay, so we've got about, in terms of the radio clock, we've got about 7 minutes remaining for a question and answer section here. And if you want to come forward, and we should have some mics being set up, you can ask. Or they're just circulating. So if anybody has a question, just raise your hand. And
I wanted to thank you all for putting this event on. And it's not really a question, more just something I'd like to add, that it can't stop here, and I'd really like to see the Tribune to continue to hold this event, because there's so many topics we didn't discuss about intersectionality of problems with gender identification, race, many other things that our community still doesn't discuss in general, just because of how conservative it is and just a lack of understanding. And I'd really like to see that continue.
Thank you.
I wanted to know if there are any things being put in place or if there are, you know, things that to help the victims work through this. You know, we've talked about prevention and what could have been done or whatever, but what kinds of things are being done to help the victims after the fact? And if the schools are, you know, providing that kind of help for the victims?
I can speak to that. So something that I've been advocating for with BYU is putting a victim advocate in there so the victim can be walked through, the victim can know what's actually going on. You can probably speak more to what a victim advocate can do.
Well, to go into different resources and things that are available to help survivors through this, at least here in the Salt Lake Valley, we have a phenomenal organization called the Rape Recovery Center. The Rape Recovery Center they have counselors who do private one-on-one counseling. Additionally, they have group support groups, and they have secondary survivor support groups. So for anybody who loves a survivor and they're having a hard time coping with it, there's resources available to them. Also here in the state of Utah, we have Utah Crime Victim Reparations, which they will help pay for some of the expenses associated with becoming a victim of any kind of a violent crime. In particular with sexual assault victims, they'll pay for the forensic examination. They will pay for some counseling if any psychotropic medication in relation to the victimization is needed. They will help pay for that. But within our community, we have victim advocates that are available at police departments, prosecutors' offices, community-based out of domestic violence shelters and the like. And then up on campus, specifically the University of Utah, we do have two full-time victim advocates, myself and one other woman, and we are available to help them through the process of reporting on a university level. On the university level, if they want to report to the Office for Equal Opportunity or the Title IX director or even the Dean of Students office, we can walk them through that process so that they don't have to do this alone. And unless if you've been a victim of a crime, these processes are extremely confusing, much less if you heap trauma on top of that. It's even more difficult. And so if we can kind of be a light to shine the way through this, that's what we want to be.
I just want to say thank you to Maddie for being a voice for yourself and for all sexual assault survivors. It takes a lot of courage to do what you're doing in the midst of your healing process. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no further questions, we will wrap it up here. Again, I want to thank our panel of guests for being here tonight. Thank you so much to all of you. Thanks as well to the Salt Lake Tribune, the Leonardo, and KCPW Public Radio for putting this event on. It will be rebroadcast on KCPW next Friday. And thanks as well for all of you for coming out to this Trip Talk event, and come back for more. Thank you.